my pleasure to welcome our main speaker, Reed M. from Greensboro, North Carolina.
Hi, everybody. I'm a recovered alcoholic named Reed Martin. Can you hear me okay? If the speakers blow out on this thing, don't worry. I'll keep talking. Thank you very much. I have had a wonderful time out here. This is one of the greatest events I've been to. It was so well organized. These things are hard to put together. I do a little bit of work in the service area back home, and I'm got roped into being the DCM of my district, the largest district in three states. And we get a whole lot of people who are ready to sign up and help and work on something like this. And about a week before, me and the other guy have about had all we can take. And but that isn't what happened here. Everybody kept doing things. And I'm just really, really impressed at what all worked out beautifully. It's great. My sobriety date is May the 3rd, 2001. It was a Thursday. The first Thursday in May happens to be the National Day of Prayer. And in 2001, it was the 50th anniversary of the National Day of Prayer. I think that's real important, the self-centeredness part, because see, it took the whole United States praying at the same time to get me to go to a meeting. And if you were one of them, I want to say thank you. Because it has made a difference. I picked up that ship and haven't looked back. I've met so many people out here, and after talking to you guys and hearing from some of y'all, I almost wonder why I'm even here. You know, other places I've been, and even where I'm from, there's a lot of different things going on in Alcoholics Anonymous these days. There's a lot of different understandings and misunderstandings and behaviors of what the program is and what it's not and how we do it and how we do it wrong or how we do it right. And here it's just everybody's so like-minded. So we're going to spend about an hour and we're going to talk about a bunch of things we all agree about. And that's about it. Somebody who wasn't mentioned I have to call on is Rick Wilson right here. And Rick called me up about, I don't know, 6 months ago and said, what are you doing in September? And I said, well, he said, I don't care, good. I need you to come see us. Can you come? And I've got a new best friend here in Ventura County. And if you don't know Rick, you should get to know him. And I don't mean at a meeting where everybody's watching because he'll have to, you know, put on that thing, but get it, pull him aside. Pull him aside somewhere and do that one alcoholic with another thing and you'll have a new friend too. My story is tragic and fun and exciting and miserable, and there's laughing and crying and all kinds of things and injuries and explosions and really there are burn units and hospitals and that stuff is really interesting, and it takes a long time. And I usually start talking really, really fast, about 5 minutes till time to start, because I got to hurry up and get sober. And so what I started doing a while back is I kind of said, well, you know, we've kind of already gotten there. My sponsor reminds me that my job is to be at the place. It's not to be helpful. Page 102 of the book. My job is to be at the place where I can be of maximum helpfulness to others. And so I'm here. And, you know, at this point I prayed earlier that I'll leave now. And my higher power come down and you'll hear whatever you're supposed to hear. That Thursday back in May was an interesting time. I had just been out of the state mental hospital for about 2 weeks. A little bit before that, I was 36 years old. I didn't have what I wanted in my life. Everything I'd ever had, I'd ruined. Everybody I ever loved, I had seen in their face, heard from them in mail, email, or from a lawyer, that they didn't like me and didn't ever want to see me again. And and had seen disappointment on everyone I cared about, especially after I swore to myself that I wouldn't ever do it to him again, and I did it to him again. I didn't really want to do this anymore. So many people I've heard at meetings will say things like, I mean, we'll hear all kinds of things at meetings. They'll say, you know, if you drink, you'll die. You know, and if I had been told that in the beginning, I would have asked, where do I go sign? Where do I get that ticket? Because I'm ready. I'm done. I don't measure up to what I would like to measure up to. I can't do this life in any way, form, or fashion, and I'm done. And right before, in April, I decided that with the help of a large bottle of gin. And put a garden hose in the exhaust pipe of my truck and fired it up and started drinking and was later revived by the sheriff's department. And these guys, even though I did what drunks do, you know, leave me alone and kind of woke up and started fighting and kicking and do girls fight when y'all wake up? I don't know. We do, guys. We fight. It doesn't matter who it's with. And they didn't take me to jail. They took me to the health department, where I spent the whole night. And the next morning, a doctor came in and said, well, you know, whether it was attention or whatever, it doesn't matter. You know, if somebody does something like that for attention, guess what? They win. And in the state of North Carolina, a second doctor has to decide if you actually get the prize. And so they put me in a paddy wagon. Well, of course, I was still mad and angry. They put me in this cage, like this big dog kennel is what it was. It's chain link, and they put me in this big dog kennel overnight, and I tried to rip it off the ceiling because I don't know why. That would have made a difference somehow. And so, well, it was a good idea. You had to be there. And so they put me into these handcuffs and these shackles, which are bigger handcuffs, if you haven't had any. They're just like, and then they put a chain between them with a padlock and put me, loaded me like a suitcase into a paddy wagon where there were three other guys, that weren't chained or handcuffed. And we rode for 2 hours down the state mental hospital. I ended up there. It was a crazy place. It was four crazy people. I mean, it wasn't, you know, there's some people say, well, there's a treatment center. No, this is the crazy ward. This is psych ward, whatever you want to call it. That's where I was, and I couldn't get out. I went in, I did the little interview. They asked me what day it was. You know, asked me my name. And I answered all the questions correctly. And somehow they made a mistake, and I failed the test. And I got to stay. And anyway, I got out of that place. But while I was in there, all the airs that I had held up, you know, I mean, because when I was drinking like this and doing all these other things, you know, all the drugs and stuff like that, and I'm going to bounce around a lot. That happens. There's only a few brain cells left. There's like three or four. They don't like each other, and they don't get along. You know, I mentioned the drug thing, and I didn't see anybody leave yet, but they're about to. And so, you know, I studied the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. To me, it is a copyrighted work. It's a program owned by Alcoholics Anonymous World Services Incorporated. It's not a word of mouth program. It's not something somebody said today. I was talking with, was it Rhonda? Is she here? You here, Rhonda? No, she didn't make it. We were talking, and she says, "Yeah, I heard out there they said," and I said, "Oh, well, that's just it, Ron. It's not an out there program. It's a book." And we heard a minute ago, you know, the description of the alcoholic chapter of the Agnostic and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage right all of them. First sentence was the description of the alcoholic. And on page 21 and 22, it talks about the description of the alcoholic. I know you all already know this, but that's, you should have called somebody else. this is what I do. I don't have something new. It's the same program. And there's a sentence in there, and it says on page 22, it says, this is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, because as our behavior patterns vary. But this description should identify him roughly. Oh, well, what description? Well, it goes before that. On page 21, it starts and says, here's the fellow who's been puzzling you, right? You remember that? And it goes on and on. It says all kinds of things about him. And then it gets to this point, and it says, as matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedatives and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. And it goes on and on, and you know, then he gets drunk all over again and can't take it. And maybe he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some other sedatives. Anyway, our behavior patterns may vary. Mine varied a little bit, and sometimes I thought that the drugs were better. Sometimes I thought the alcohol was better. And the best thing is whenever I went to the doctor and I got a prescription and it said, alcohol may intensify effect. My first thought was like so many great cooks I know that say, do we have baking soda? Do we have gin? Do we have gin? I need to stop at the get some gin on the way home. So there's drugs in my story. I don't apologize for it. It's in Bill's story. It's in Bob's story. And according to the description of the alcoholic, it's a typical symptom of a real alcoholic. I was on all that stuff, and I got out of this mental hospital while I was there. My whole family and all my friends, even though I dressed up in suits, and went out to the bars and tried to look all together, they didn't know that there was trash on the floor of every room of my house, knee deep. They didn't know that I was living in one little room or a portion of a room where the boxes, the hallways were boxes stacked on either side, and you had to kind of turn sideways to get through this place, and it was nasty and dirty, and the ashtrays had never been emptied except for when I knocked them over. And then I just picked them up. And so, we're cigarette butts and beer cans and trash all over the floor, and it's nasty, and that's where I live. And people went there to go try to take care of things while I was locked up, and they saw that, and the cat was out of the bag. So when I got back home, it didn't matter anymore. And I could drink like I really wanted to. And I could do everything because it didn't matter. Everybody knew there was nothing to hide anymore. So I did. And I went out this one night. I had previously driven my car out. And we had this little outfit called Designated Driver. A company called Designated Driver. And what they would do is if you got to the bar and you drank too much, you handed your keys to the bartender, you got a free drink, and they called these people. And for $20, they came and they got you, and they brought a driver who drove your car home. They drove you and your car, right? Neat trick. But that was getting expensive. So I said, I should just call the cab now. And so I take a cab out. Go to a bar and this and that and get hammered. I get the bartender's number, put it in my phone. You need to be back here at 2 a.m. when the bar's closed. They close back then, back east. They don't stay open around the clock. Because then when all the liquor's gone and the liquor store's closed, we're going to have to get some other things to make it till morning. We'll have to head downtown. So we did that. And along the way, I encounter this young lady, and she had like a third shift job. Can we say that here? And she knew where to go find these things and get them and did. And we exchanged information. She was kind of, I don't know, she was like a hostess, if you will. Very friendly. And she said, we're riding this cab to go to this place because they won't take, anyway, they need to see somebody they know or they won't open the door. And she's like, so, what's your story? She says. And I said, well, I just got out of a state mental hospital for trying to kill myself. And I have a pocket full of money, and I'm going to turn it into a pocket full of everything I can find, and I'm going to do every bit of it by myself until I pass out or my heart stops. What's your story? We became instant friends. Later, she called me, and I apparently was in transition from living places, and needed a room, and I had lots of rooms, and I swept some, used a push broom, swept some crap out of the way, and she used one of the rooms in the house, and had folks that would deliver everything. They'd go by the liquor store, the beer store, and Carlos's house, and all at once, and they'd all come, and I didn't have to drive anywhere. So this was great, and so we woke up after about 7 days of being awake one day, and it was May the 3rd, 2001. We went to this doctor's office, and she had this earache that wouldn't go away, and I said, an infection, you know, the stuff you're doing, antibiotics won't work, you need something a little stronger. And she said, well, you tell the doctor. We get in there and do all this, and I somehow told the doctor the wrong thing. I'm not real good sometimes at communicating. I misled him or something. I said, doctor kind of got a little substance abuse issue. Or he was like, that's fantastic. My name's Phil. I'm an alcoholic. How long have you been sober? And I told him, it'd been almost 2 hours. And so he sits down. He tells us about Alcoholics Anonymous. He tells us his story. He didn't ask any questions. He told us about himself. And he wasn't in a hurry to get into the next room. He told us about himself. And he told us what happened and what he got. And he said, these people are just like you. And they're happy. And they're doing really well. You ought to meet them. You ought to go find them. And I said, well, where do we find these people? He said, that's the easiest part. You dial 411 and ask for Alcoholics Anonymous. And he made it sound very attractive. He wouldn't give up the goods, you know. He didn't say, oh, well, I'll take you. Or here, let me write out a map for you. He just said, well, if you really want to know, do it yourself, basically, is what he said. And that made me want to know even more. Because, see, this girl, she was sick. She needed help. This girl needed a lot of help. So we left. I call on my cell phone. It's 6:25. I'm listening to the voice, the recording. There's a meeting that starts in 5 minutes at the next stoplight as I was driving. And we pulled in there. It was a small meeting. And the folks were talking for a while. And I don't remember much. I don't remember much, and I really don't remember much about the whole first year, for that matter. But one thing that sticks out, this lady, I guess they probably, knowing some things now, they went around the room, they recognized, hey, there's some dope fiends and drunks in here. Let's tell them what this life can be like. And they went around the room one at a time in a circle, and this lady said, she hadn't missed a day of work in 6 years. She said her lights hadn't been cut off in 6 years. And that was really the one that got me, because I had money in the bank still. I had worked in commercial real estate for many years and was doing pretty well and was getting fat checks every so often for doing nothing. Sorry about that recession, folks. It wasn't all my fault. I was just a small... But my lights got cut off about every 60 days because I didn't go out to the mailbox and check the mail, and they would cut it off, and I'd call and turn it on with the credit card. But they said things, whatever they said, in about 10 minutes I just started crying in there, because I knew right away, wow, this might be the problem. This could be the solution. There might be a way for me to get better. We go home. We get the white chip. We go home, and we have white chips there, surrender chips, and dumped out everything I had, And I think this part's important too. I have this old farmhouse that came free with a piece of land that I bought, I invested in back in the real estate days. So I'm in this old house, and I've dumped everything out, every bottle and everything, and I'm sitting there and I'm like, wow, this is, here we go. This is, I'm starting something here. And lined on both sides of the sink are these shelves, and they're just packed as tight as they can be with all these prescription bottles and medicines and all these things for all the doctors I've been to, with mental medical history, this thick. And, you know, I said to myself, but even if I quit drinking and any of this other mess I've been doing, I'm still not normal. People still don't like to be around me. People still don't like me because there's still things wrong with me. And alcoholics can be impulsive. And so I said, oh, but those people said I could quit anything. And I dumped them all out. That's not recommended. I didn't sleep for 11 days, but I did dump them all out, and I'm glad that I did, because I could not have made it to day 12. I could not have made it. The shaking and the sweating, somewhere in the middle of there, day 3 or 4, that young lady didn't try anymore, and she left. And Marianne, if you're out there in the world, I hope you're okay. But I went back, and I kept going back, and they said keep coming back, and I did that, that helping one alcoholic helping another thing, you know, there was guys with years and years and whatever, months, they swarmed me after meetings, because that's the way they did things back then. I'm sure you all do that here. And one guy would come up and he'd say, I've got 4 years, or I've got 8 years, or I've got 10. I'm like, yeah, yeah. And this kid comes up and he says, I got 14 days. I said, I need to talk to you. What day did you fall asleep? And he said it was about day 10. And that's really about how it worked out. It was the withdrawals and the sweating. I felt my bones felt like they were in a microwave. And that was the worst experience I've ever had. And I've had some bad ones. The stuff that I don't want to waste a lot of time on. The part about the plane crash when I was 12 years old. Woke up in the wreckage and crawled forward to watch my dad take his last breaths. And many others. I've been hit and beat up and knocked down a bunch of times. But that was a painful experience. That quitting thing. I kept going to meetings. On my 8th day, going to meetings, and that sponsorship thing, I would go, and there would be guys standing around after the meeting. I walk up to them after the meeting. I'd say, because I was picking up some lingo, and I said, they'd kind of hanging out, so I'd go hang out, because that's what I thought the program was. That's what I was starting to think it was. And they might be talking about sponsors, and I said, I think I need a sponsor. And they would say, you sure do. And they'd walk away. And finally some guy came and told me the secret. He said, you have to ask someone. So we're doing that. And I'm thinking about this. I'm going to a meeting every single minute of the day. Every single minute of the day. I can't make it. The one day at a time was not made for me, and the parts of every bit of my story is not made for anybody else but me. This is what I went through. This is what I saw along the way. Skipping around again. I don't really do the general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. At page 27, that tells me they got one hope when they wrote that. And this is how I read it. Okay, yeah, they said our hope is that the alcoholic man or woman, desperate. In need, we'll read these stories, and we believe it's only by fully disclosing our innermost selves and our problems that they'll be led to say, wow, I'm one of these people. I must have this thing. This is AA convention, people, so you're here. You probably already think you have this thing, so let's move on and get to what to do about it. If we were one-on-one in 12-step call, it tells me that, a man properly armed with the facts about himself can gain the entire confidence of another in a few hours. A few hours, okay, Claudia? No.
Yeah.
So, we don't have a few hours. I'll just tell you what I saw. My best direction for what I do up here comes from AA Comes of Age, one of my favorite books by Bill Wilson. July 1955, he gets in front of like 30,000 people. To tell his story or to give a talk, and he gets up there, and I'm sure they wanted to hear about the brokerage and the drinking and the motorcycle. I want to hear about the motorcycle. He got up there and he said, it's traditional in AA that we do not make speeches. We simply talk about our own experiences and, Rick, about the experiences of those around us. Which means I'll talk about you too. If I saw you, the things that I've seen. So this is how it went. And I went to a meeting at 8 in the morning. I got out of that. I didn't know what to do. I went at breakfast with these old guys because that's what they said. They said, "You want to come eat?" And I said, "I don't have any money." They said, "We didn't ask you if you had any money." And so I went to eat with them. And then I went to a meeting at 12. And then I hung out with those folks for a little while and went to lunch. I knew not to say any bring up the money thing. That was a problem when the bill came. And then I went to the 5:30 meeting, which where I'm from is called happy hour, which I did still don't understand. It's like the saddest 60 minutes on the planet. So, and then I went to the 8 o'clock, and then on the weekends there was the 10 o'clock, and then the midnight. So I mean, I'm going to 3, 4, 5 meetings a day my first week. So I did my 90 in a week. And, well, I wanted to get better faster, and so I wanted to move ahead quickly. And so day 8, I'm at this meeting, and I don't know what it was on. I think it was on gratitude. And so I'm well versed. You know, I've done the accelerated version of the program through self study and independent study, so to speak. And so it's time for me to share, and I've got some gratitude. And so I tell these people about how I had been at some meeting where they closed the meeting with this little prayer, a little moment of silence for the alcoholic who might walk by outside tonight and not even know we're here. And I went, "That is me. Y'all, we're praying for me." Because I was the guy who went. This church was located on this little road that goes down to a cemetery where my dad was buried when I was 12 years old in 1977. And I've been going there for 23 years, and sitting there, because when that happened, and I lost him in the blink of an eye, it was tough. And it was just a short while later, because my mother developed cancer that same summer, that she ended up there when I was 19. And then when I was about 28 and just barely about to come out of this thing, somebody kidnapped my sister. And she was missing for a year, and then she was found murdered. And at that point, we put a bench out there, and I would go and sit. And so for 23 years, I'm going down this road past this church where these people are that I don't know about. And I think I'm doing pretty good with my gratitude, right? I'm on topic. I'm not missing anything. And this dude across the room, he's bald and he's got tattoos up to his neck, and he just cuts me off in the middle of a big meeting. He just starts talking. "I'm John." I'm like, "I'm not done here." And he looks over at me. He's got this big knife that he's cleaning his fingernails with it, because he had just eaten an apple with it. I think they call him a cutlass. It's a big pirate knife. It's curved, you know. And this guy's huge and muscles and tattoos, and he's got this knife in his hand. And he says, "Listen here, dude. You cannot ever go back to that cemetery ever again and be the same person. I know you can't. You can't because now you've got something you've never had. You've got hope. You didn't have that before, and now you got it." And he says, "I know you got it because you tell us that you came here, which means you think you had a problem, you know, that you couldn't do this. So there's step one. You came back, which means you think we could do it. Duh, take a look at us versus you." And so that's a power greater than you, at least to start with one. He says, "Now it's up to you to make a decision. Are you going to let us help you? And one of the best ways you can let us help you is to stop talking and start listening." And, you know, he really said that in a very matter-of-fact way, not a shut-up way. I was terrified enough by the knife, but I was just pretty amazed that somebody took an interest in me. And I think we call it taking the whole meeting hostage and crosstalk and all that. Nobody said anything to him. Maybe I told him he had a knife. And so, but he took an interest in me, and I was part of the group now. I was welcomed. I was accepted. And so I asked around. Everybody knew who he was. He was this big celebrity. He had tattoo shops and tattoo parlors and the biggest tattoo convention in the Southeast. And he'd been on Discovery Channel. And he was a big deal. And he'd been in prison. And he didn't go anywhere without two little drunkards. Had a new one every day, two new ones dragging along, and they're carrying stuff, and he's pushed, sit down, and he had new guys all the time, he's pulling them around, and I thought he had a labor service or something. So I call him up and ask him if he'll be my sponsor, and he says, yeah, I will. Meet me over at this AA club at 8 o'clock in the morning, I'll see you there, bye. And I can't wait, because not only, he said yes, and he's a celebrity, he said he's a big time day. I didn't get a run of the mill sponsor. This is the guy. It's like having a big brother. It's like, I'm going to tell my brother what you. This is a really neat thing. So I get there. He comes in late. Strolls in. Big room. Leans against the wall. With his head back, like he's sleeping. It was just embarrassing because I'm telling everybody my sponsor is coming. You got to check this guy out. And so he's one of those guys. He'd lean forward every once in a while and say something like, "That's not what the book says." Because people were—I don't know—they respected him or they were afraid of him or that he would cut off the whole. At the end of a meeting, sometimes he would say, "You know, the only thing you guys said about recovery was when you read the steps." He was just really tough and mean and rude and vulgar, and he had printed t-shirts that said he did things to your wife or girlfriend. I can't say them up here. So for a little while I had a resentment because I was like, uh-huh, I knew somebody was doing that. But anyway. My head went. So I run up to him after this meeting, and I'm like, "What? Okay, I'm ready to do this thing. I'm excited. I'm ready to go. I don't want to live this way. You know, making this week is I hadn't slept. I've been up since 4 waiting for this damn meeting to start. So what do we do? How do we do this AA thing?" And he pointed at two other guys sitting on the wall who were looking at the floor, and he said, "You're going to give those two guys a ride home. I brought them here. You're taking them home." And I said, "Okay. I thought you misunderstood my question." I'm like, "Just give them a ride home." He's like, "Yeah, get their phone numbers, find out what meeting they want to go to tonight. If they can't get there, you go get them and you take them. And tomorrow morning, call them, wake them up early." That's why I was late. So they'll, you know, they won't get up. You need to call them a couple times and bring them here, get them here if they can't get here, and I'll see you tomorrow. And he started walking out the door. And so now I knew he didn't hear what I said. But I didn't know what to do. I was scared. I'm shaking still. My bones are still in the microwave, it feels like. He's got a knife. I don't know what to do. So I just do what the man says, and I do that. And Little John was his name. And some people know Little John. He traveled all over the world. And Little John would keep making me do things, keep making me help people. For about the first 90 days, I drove guys to meetings. I was the AA transportation service. I drove people to meet every meeting, you know, morning, noon, night. They would just come up to me in flocks after me. 12 o'clock, you got me at 12 o'clock? And then 8:30, "Hey, listen, Thursday, we need a couple people." "Yeah, you got it, I'm there." I had nothing else to do. And I couldn't be alone. I couldn't make it a whole day without drinking. I could not do that. So I did that stuff. And after a while, Little John raises the bar. We're at a meeting, and he picks up this book right here. Or he goes over to the literature table. It was a long time ago. It was $6 at the Dawn Patrol. And he says, "You got $6? I'm like, "Well, of course I've got $6. And he says, give me the $6. And he says, "You're buying a book." And we buy the book. And he didn't really have me start reading it right away. He says, you need to, but I know you're not going to. But he had me keep doing stuff. Every once in a while, he would call and assign new people to pick up. and say, go pick up this guy, take him to this meeting, I'll meet you there. He wouldn't show up. So now I got this guy. And what he was doing, I think most of y'all already know this. I mean, this guy was tricking me. He didn't tell me, hey, look, if you will spend your time trying to help somebody else, it'll help take your mind off what's bugging you. It'll help take your mind off wanting to drink, wanting to do other things, and you're going to get, we're going to keep you around long enough to get some sense into you. He just said, do it, and not just with me, but he was doing like 20 at a time. You know, I was a number, I think. I don't know. And he was really something else. And I did that. After a while, my mind was starting to come together, and we read through the book a little bit together. He'd point out some stuff. He'd pick meetings I was supposed to go to where they read out of the book. It got to be pretty regular. If they don't have the book, then you're at the wrong meeting. And Little John got sober in prison, and that's all they had was a book. He was somewhere where they didn't even have meetings coming in. He had a book. And some guys, and so we did this stuff and raised the bar at some point. I love this part of the story. I don't know when I started. We go till 11, right?
11.
Yeah. So just tell me a quarter till. He raised the bar a little bit. There's a treatment center nearby. He's like, okay, so now you need to get a commitment. You need to get something to do. You know, they've got these vans you can drive. Once you've been sober 6 months, you can go up there and start this fight. I go sign up, and I'm a volunteer driver, and I'd seen some other people doing that. It seemed pretty special. I get out of the van, and one day, going to the very first meeting I'd ever driven them to, and I walk up to some other folks that I knew had been doing it, you know, and now I was as cool as them, if not better, because I probably did it better. And I said, I drove the van. And this one guy says, that's really nice, Reed. I did that every week for a year. And I said, well, that's 52 weeks. That's 10 people in a van. 520. You took 520 people to a meeting. Wow, that is something else. He said, well, I missed a couple weeks. I went, see, you're not all that. And he said, yeah, one week my father died, and the other week I was in the hospital. But I was there every other time because it's not worth doing unless you make a commitment. So you'll do it when you don't want to. That is what we have to do. We have to commit ourselves to being somewhere for somebody else because our brain will take us somewhere else. And I said, okay. I didn't really hear any of that. I realized that took 2 weeks off, so now we're talking 50 weeks. That's times 10. That's 500 people we took to upset. And this miracle obsession. And so 500, and he said, 500 is pretty good. I took 10. He said, did 5. I'll take 1,000. That's what I'll do. I'll show him. I'll take 1,000 people to a meeting. So I had the little piece of paper that they gave me with the names on it. And next week when I came back, I got the next piece of paper. And I went 11, 12, 13, 14. And I added them up. And I went home every week and I stuck that thing on the bulletin board. And I kept it going. And I'd be at 200. And then I'd be at 300. And I'd be at 400. And then after all, one day this Sergeant Carter, anybody ever watched that show? This fellow, Sergeant Carter, he busts into an AA meeting in the morning. And he says, look. How about that treatment center you've been driving for? We got this little halfway house where people, after they go through treatment, we need a little help over there. Get these guys going and help them wash their clothes and show them how to put the dish in this dishwasher. Anyway, we need some help up there on the weekends. We were thinking about you. And I said, wow. Okay. And so I go through this whole process and I meet the people up there and going through the final interview and stuff, and it's not that big of a deal. I'm sure you figured that out by now, but I was amazed that somebody wanted me to participate in something like that, and that somehow I was worthy of being that kind of helpful. And at the very end, the guy says, oh, by the way, you can't drive the vans anymore. I'm like, whoa, dude. I got this 1,000-person goal. Everybody knows about it. And I'm at 936. It's time for you to change your goals, bud. And that's it. Change your goals. And moved on. So, but I did. I took 936 people to a meeting. I took 935 of them back. I only lost one. might be where the counting thing. Anyway, so I did this for a while, and what happened there is I got tricked. Little John tricked me into helping others, tricked me into doing the work that it talks about in the book. And somewhere around 2 years, I don't know, 18 months, I started to get real uncomfortable in meetings. I started to notice and not be comfortable anymore in this. My home group is I have two home groups. One's Big Book 2, T-O-O, because there's a Big Book home group. We're Big Book 2. False. Anyway. And the other one's the Primary Purpose Group, Big Book Study, where we both do this about the same thing. And just study the book. And what I was reading in that meeting and what I was seeing at all the meetings I was going to weren't matching up. What it said in the book and what people did and said at meetings weren't matching up. And I was having a lot of trouble with that. And I was still doing that stuff that Little John had forced me into doing, and I kept raising the bar, and I kept hearing those things that other people were doing, and I didn't know it, but I was getting the benefits from that stuff. I was feeling alive. There's so many times I had that silly commitment going to go drive the stupid van, and I didn't want to go, and I was tired, and I had a new job, and it sucked because if anybody could ever get a first job in recovery, they suck. And so I don't want to go. I call, can you get somebody else to drive? No, you got to be here. And I go, and on the way home, I'm almost in tears. So I met a guy who the only thing he had left in the world was an insurance policy that his mom paid for, so that if he ever asked for help, he could go and get it. And whatever I had been upset about that day was gone. I mean, I couldn't even remember what it was. I would have to ask people. I'd call somebody. What was I mad about? You know, it would just erase it. That still happens today. I kept on doing this stuff, and it gets better. After a while, like I said, those things started bugging me. And then the rules started getting worse. Up there we have something called the North Carolina Substance Abuse Board, and they've got all these rules. And my book, I stopped saying that a while back. Your book, you guys have a book called Alcoholics Anonymous in there. It tells me that personal disclosure is one of the most powerful tools I have. My story, my history, the things I've been through is probably one of the most powerful things I have, the powerful tools. And these probably non-alcoholics that make these rules say, I can't use it. I can't use that stuff. It's called inappropriate personal disclosure. So I got mad. I got a resentment. And I said, well, what do you mean I can't say what I want to say? That book says that they called up the local hospital. I'll just call a different hospital. That's what I'll do. I'll just go somewhere else and do it, where they don't pay me and I can do whatever I want. And so I did. And this is where things really changed for me. I was getting into this funk, and recovery was just kind of going on, and it wasn't getting any better. And I'm thinking about killing myself again about every night with 2 or 3 years sober. I'm not drinking. I'm not thinking about drinking. They say you pick up where you left off. I hate it when people say they, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I left off with carbon monoxide. I know that's an outside issue, but so if I pick up where I left off, it's not looking too good. And that's exactly what is happening. That's where my thoughts are. I just don't want to try anymore. And this program, or this misinterpretation of a program, or this misinformation, or this thing that I'm doing, that just keep coming back, the 90 and 90, just don't drink, go to meetings, hang out and drink coffee, and all these little phrases, and some of them are very helpful, but they weren't doing anything for me anymore. They weren't working anymore. And the little commitments I was doing weren't working anymore, because I now know I was getting paid for them and I wasn't allowed to say what I really wanted to say, and that removes something called honesty. So I did what any good alcoholic would do. I got a resentment and took my ball and went somewhere else. And people say this all the time. Well, hold on a minute. The book says, you know, well, these guys, they figured out how to do this thing. They called up their local hospital. He can't call up the local hospital anymore and ask them if they got any first-class drugs you can talk to. And I agree with that. That's a waste of time. Google. Use Google in the 21st century. And you get a whole list. I Googled this place before I came. I was hoping maybe I could go find some first-class drugs to talk to. You couldn't even see the map. There were so many dots of places that either are treatment centers or hospitals or call them. I mean, you guys are just inundated with medical something here. I think you could walk out the door and it's like Subway, Subway House, Subway, it's just one after another. But we only had a few, and I tried a couple, and I ended up at this county place that I now call Freehab. And I love that place. And I went there my first night there. I snuck in. I stole the spot from somebody. It was Christmas Eve. And Christmas Eve, I overheard this guy saying, I can't want you to carry the meeting in there because it's Christmas Eve. And I'm like, what? You gotta be kidding me. That's the night to go. Because Christmas Eve was such a special night for me. My first Christmas Eve, I dropped the van off. This is when things started going south after they'd gone so well for about 8 or 9 months. I dropped the van off at that place. I'm getting ready to leave. I think an early relationship started to block me in this parking lot, and I got mad, and I don't remember what else went on. And all I know is I was crazy as hell, and I'd heard there were marathon meetings around the clock at Christmas. I didn't need one. I'm glad you guys had a place to go, but I didn't need one. And something happened. I was mad as hell. I drove straight to that place. I get there. I stay there all night. I didn't want to say anything. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, in the door comes Little John, my first sponsor. And beside him is Steve. Steve's my current sponsor. They were buddies back then. And little Mutt and Jeff biker dudes. They traveled all around. They'd get on their motorcycles, take tattoo needles, take off for a month, come back with more money than they had when they left. I still don't know what's up with that. But they would tattoo along the way at conventions and biker things. And they would and come back with resentments because they'd go to AA meetings, and when they'd pass the basket, they'd pick it up and they'd walk it around those guys and hand it so that they thought they'd steal the money. So. But Steve and Little John come walking in, and I said, what are you doing here? You know, I signed up to chair the meeting because there was nobody signed up, you know, for the 2 a.m. meeting. You know, I'm there at, you know, 2 a.m. Christmas Eve by myself, middle of nowhere, and it's a nasty neighborhood, and these guys walk in, and they're like, well, nobody signed up because we do it every year. Everybody knows we do it every year. I'm like, oh, well, it's not on the schedule. He's like, I just told you we do it every year. Everybody knows that you weren't here last year. Well, we don't know where you were. You're here now. Can you, like, get move over? And so we sit down, and I got to be with these two guys that I thought the world of and hear them. And in came a guy who had just gotten kicked out of Christmas at his home for the last time, so to speak. And they worked on him. One alcoholic with another, and they hammered him, and they had the book, and they were showing things and pointing out things, and so that's where I learned about Christmas, and I did that at this treatment center. I went there. I figured I'll just know what to do. I'll go in, and they were reading out of the 12 and 12, and we're going through, and they started asking me questions, like I was a teacher or something. And I said, well, that's from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Y'all read the book, big book, right? And they said, what's that? They've got the 12 and 12. They don't know what the big book is. So I said, uh-huh. And I called this place. I said, can I come here and talk to these people about the big book? They said, you mean another meeting? I said, well, no, I reverted back to what it said in the book. I reverted back to when Bill and Bob called up their local hospital and explained their need. When Bill said, I needed this alcoholic as much as he needed me. I knew I was dying, and I was going to try doing exactly what this book said because I didn't have any other choice. I couldn't ask Little John about it because at this point in things, he had gotten so famous and was doing well and was making money that he stopped helping guys. And the day came where he decided it would be a good idea to join that motorcycle gang finally and get a patch and do whatever he had to do to get into that. And then he was found dead. And I was lost. And I didn't know what to do. And all I could remember was this thing he said over and over, your job, something in the book about your job. You've got a job. Because I didn't know what to do or where to go. And I didn't know who to talk to or who. Because anybody else I would tell when I'm thinking, they'd say something stupid. Sit down and shut up. Take the cotton out of your ears and stick it in. And I'm like, I'm thinking about blowing my brains out, man. You know, all the time. And I could talk to him about that, and he would take it seriously. And now he was gone. And so I dig through the book, and I find this page, 102, your job now. I told you about that earlier. Be at the place. So I went to this place. And I start teaching these people the big book. And I've been doing it now a long time. I go there every week now. At one point, they call me back, made me go twice, or asked if I would go twice a week. I couldn't wait. I did. And I've never tried to memorize anything out of this book. It's through teaching it. It's through being in a room and people raise their hand and say, well, what about the such and such? And I turn to the page and I point at it and I read it. And the 47th time I say, permanent recovery? Yeah, that's mentioned 3 times. I can explain right there where it is at page 14. You know, I got that confused. Oh, I'm going to do that a lot. XBI, an alcoholic fails to perfect Bill and Bob. This seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another as no non-alcoholic could. It also indicated the strenuous work. One alcoholic with another was vital to permanent recovery. And I said, how come we don't have topics about permanent recovery? And I started teaching these people this stuff. They started picking up this toolkit and they started running with it. And in there, I met so many people who were more open-minded about this written down, copyrighted version of the program than that word of mouth thing that they had failed at. They called themselves chronic relapsers. I found out they actually had something called chronic untreated alcoholism. And they, every week there'd be some new people and he'd raise his hand and he'd say, I tried AA and AA doesn't work. And I would say, well, what did you try? He said, well, I drank coffee with people, I went to meetings, I sat in a chair, I listened to people talk about their problems. And I'm like, oh, that AA. That's the other A. And they said, well, what do you mean by that? I'm like, well, there's these 3 different AAs. There's not one, there's 3 different ones. There's this thing that you're talking about, that where people go and they talk, you know. Anybody here ever been to a bar? Okay, well, we have one. Okay. So you know about it. Okay, I'll tell you. At bars, frequently, usually, there's a guy or a girl. It's often a guy sitting in the same chair every time you go. And this guy, no matter what the conversation that he overhears, because he wasn't invited into it, says something like, well, I know what they could do to fix this country. Let me tell you. Or if you're about to worry about a problem at work, he says, well, I can tell you what you need to do about that. You know, he's got an idea. He's got a solution for everything. These guys are really smart. They're any bar. You'll find him. It doesn't matter. You just go. Sometimes these people get sober and they show up in AA meetings. And they will tell you how to, you know what you need to do? I'll tell you what you, relationship? I'll tell you, come here. I'll tell you all about that. You know, I know it says this on page such and such in the book, but that's not really the program. Let me tell you, that's what they say. There's that AA. This word of mouth AA. This hearsay AA thing. That's one of them. the meetings and groups. It's open to the public. There's no charge. There's no background check. There's no fees or dues. There's no requirements for membership other than a desire to stop drinking, and no one asks. You know, excuse me, you're, before you come in there, do you have a desire to stop drinking? Okay. Next. Nobody checks. Just anybody in and out, in and out. It doesn't matter. So anybody can say anything they want. There's that A. And then there's the meetings, the organized part of it, the printed meeting lists, the printed schedules, the AA clubhouses, the AA group rooms where the steps are on the wall and there's microphones and it says AA on the door and there's greeters and that's the fellowship. And those people are probably like you guys. When you leave here, you go practice a program called AA. And when you come here, you practice a fellowship called AA, and you have fun, and you laugh, and you hang out, and you do things together, and you make fast friends. That's the other A. And then there's a third one. I said there were three. The third one is a copyrighted intellectual property called Alcoholics Anonymous. They all have the same name, you see. It's pretty confusing. Well, it is. I know it's funny, but that's really what I have observed. This is just my opinion. This is how I've seen it happen. And yeah, I'm giving you an opinion here. This is what I've looked at. And there's these different things. And so when a person comes in, I don't think anybody's misled. I don't think there's any people who don't want to do the program. It's hard. It's figuring out where it is. It's kind of hard. And but this one is the program of AA. So I'm doing this thing, I'm teaching this thing to people, they're picking up this toolkit and they're going along, they said AA doesn't work, and they say, I can't go to AA because I did drugs. I tell them about the description of the alcoholic, they go, huh, what else you got in there? You know, I'm like, well, there's lots of things in here, you know. There's all kinds of things, you know. Are you trying to help other people? Well, I can't do that. That's step 12. I got to wait a year or two to do that. I'm like, what do you mean you got to wait a year or two to do that? You know, you got to do that right away so you can get this spiritual awakening or psychic change. Why do I need a psychic change? Well, because if you're a real alcoholic, you need a psychic change. That's what the doctor's opinion says. Well, you know, and so I go through and I show them that stuff. I tell them that stuff and exactly where it is. And they picked up it. I went through this stuff. This big, huge guy comes up to me after a meeting one time. He's pounding his chest. He's like, now you give me something I can use. Now you give me something I can use. Psychic change. The doctor's opinion. Let me give you this real quick. You've heard it before, but sometimes we skip sentences. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems to be the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless they can again experience that sense of ease and comforts which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, then the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree. We call that a binge now. Emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope in his recovery. They switch this psychic change and vital spiritual experience up all the time. On page 27, this guy goes to a doctor and he says, you know, doc, I can't stop drinking. What do I do? What's wrong with me? Doctor basically says, you're screwed, fella. You have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I had never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, no exception. The doctor says, yes, there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and then, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are a phenomenon. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of motives begin to dominate them. That's what's required for a real chronic alcoholic. Everything that I had going for me had to be dumped. And I had to start with something fresh, something new, and go the other way. I do this all the time, like I said, this prehab thing. And that's where I learned so much. If you haven't ever done that, and you don't think you've experienced the benefits of Alcoholics Anonymous that you see in other people when they say, "I'm happy to be alive." Yeah, I get sick of those people, but I'm one of them now. And because Bill said, you know, many times I went to my old hospital in despair. Upon talking to a man there, it would be amazing. He lifted up and sat on my feet. The commitment I had for the bands was one thing. It worked for a while. It did. The service part worked for a while. But service is a service. It's not helping others. I threw this. Any GSRs in here? Group service representatives? Yeah. I gave my GSRs their homework recently and tell them that they need to know all of the required texts. It's on AA.org. You'll be amazed at the list. It's scary. One of them is the pamphlet, P16, The Home Group. And in there, when it comes to that service thing, it says there's a tradition of giving newcomers service positions because this will help keep them stay sober. Conference approved pamphlet, folks. Next line says, "Our experience indicates that this is not so." This does not work. Service is a service. The basis of the program is one alcoholic helping one other alcoholic. One alcoholic helping another. Which often happens when you're in a room this big and everybody left and there's 400 chairs. You might start talking. So I tell these people this stuff, like we just did, this chronic alcoholic. And finally, one day, a guy asked a question that I think was real brilliant. Or there were a couple questions that led to it. It made perfect sense. And I think it's something where the folks who slip through the cracks and they keep going in and out, where it matters. There's a couple of points. One of them is, okay, this doctor's opinion and this big book dumper, or y'all might have a different name for them, that's what we call them, is saying the only way an alcoholic can get sober, the only way, is a vital spiritual experience, an entire psychic change. If that's true, then how come there's hundreds or thousands of people going to meetings who just don't drink and go to meetings and drink coffee and hang out and eat pizza and play frisbee, and they're sitting in a chair and they leave before the prayer and they're doing okay? How come there's that group if there's only one way? Why is that? I think that's a pretty fair question. It's a very fair question. The way I can answer it the best is with a little illustration that they put into the Wives chapter. They describe the progression of an alcoholic. Those of you who have been at this for a while, 25, 30 years, 40 years, you've seen this over and over, it doesn't matter. You've been in rooms this big 20 years ago, and you look around this year, and there's three of you left. And there's the same number of people. Or at your home group, if you've been there 5 years in certain parts of the country, you look around and 5 years later, there's three of you left. You know, that sitting in the chair stuff does not work. But page 110. I pull stuff out of the program because I didn't write it. And it's in your book. Just bear with me here. Husband number 4, his description. Everybody hates this chapter and it's so packed with information. You may have a husband of whom you completely despair. He's been placed in one institution after another. He is violent or appears definitely insane when drunk. Sometimes he drinks on the way home from the hospital. I did that from the state mental hospital. I couldn't make it home. I had to call and have the dope man meet me halfway. I was just glad that the cabbie was willing to sign me out of the hospital for $20. Perhaps he has had DTs. Doctors may shake their heads and advise you to have him committed. Maybe you've already been obliged to put him away. After each one of these little short descriptions, they give a summation in here. What do you think they said about this guy? I mean, this is bad. They said, this picture may not be as dark as it looks. Many of our husbands were just as far gone, yet they all got well. It's only four of them, there's three more. Husband number three, what's his story? This husband has gone much further than husband number two. Though once like number two, he became worse. His friends have slipped away. His home is a near wreck. And he cannot hold a position. This was me. Maybe the doctor has been called in and the weary round of sanitariums and hospitals has begun. Today we call them detoxes and treatment centers. He admits he cannot drink like other people, but does not see why. He clings to the notion that he will yet find a way to do so. He may have come to the point where he desperately wants to stop, but cannot. His case presents additional questions, which we shall try to answer for you. Sounds bad. What do they say about this guy? You can be quite hopeful of a situation like this. Okay, so we got these four. It's supposed to get worse. We're down to the last three, number three and four, and they're saying this is all right. This is no big deal. We can handle this. Why is that? I know it's long. It's a long walk to get there, but that question of those folks who do this hangout program and those folks who really dig their teeth in, what's the difference? Why do you have to do it one way? Why does it work for these others? Number two, your husband is showing lack of control, for he is unable to stay on the water wagon even when he wants to. He often gets entirely out of hand when drinking. He admits this is true, but is positive he will do better. He has begun to try with or without your cooperation. Various means of moderating or staying dry. He is beginning to lose his friends. This guy's still got friends. His business may suffer somewhat. He's got a business. He's worried at times. He's becoming aware he cannot drink like other people. He sometimes drinks in the morning. Sometimes. Through the day also. To hold his nervousness in check, he is remorseful after serious drinking bouts. This guy's sorry. He's not even having blackouts. He knows what he did. But when he gets over the spree, he begins to think once more how he can drink moderately next time. It's not too bad, right? What do you think they say about this guy? Do y'all know what they say about this guy? We think this person is in danger. These are the earmarks of a real alcoholic. There's only one more, folks. Husband number one. Your husband may be only a heavy drinker. His drinking may be constant, or it may be heavy only on certain occasions. Perhaps he spends too much money for liquor. It may be slowing him up mentally and physically, that he does not see it. Sometimes he is a source of embarrassment to you and his friends. No, well, not every time. He's positive he can handle his liquor, that it does him no harm, that drinking is necessary in his business to get the, you know, you've got to do it. He would probably be insulted if he were called an alcoholic. This world is full of people like him. This world is full of people like him. Some will moderate or stop altogether. And some will not. Those who keep on a good number will become true alcoholics after a while. The whole world is full of them. Some of them will just stop. A few of them will keep on with these other two, three, and fours. What do they say about this? Well, it just says they're going to move on. So we here it is. You may not see it yet. Okay, we got the world full of people who can stop. They only drink on certain occasions. It's necessary for their business. So they go to a company party. I'll use an example. I call this guy Richard. Richard goes to the company party and he drinks at the party because he has to. This is a business function. He wouldn't go normally because he's a nerd. And He drives home. He gets a DUI on the way home. Lawyer tells him he ought to go to AA because it'll look good when he goes to court. So he goes to AA, and Richard walks into AA, and he's looking around, and he says, as people go through, he starts to click. He likes what everybody's saying. They're getting along really well. He clicks. That's a bad sign for Richard, by the way. And they go around the room, and everybody says, "Hi, I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic. I'm Jamie, and I'm Jack." And he says, "Well, hi, I'm Dick. I'm an alcoholic." He starts calling himself an alcoholic out of nowhere. This world's full of people like him. This fellowship's full of people like him. Not necessarily yours. Mine back home is. And those people can stop. And when you tell them, "Don't drink and go to meetings," they don't drink and go to meetings. And Richard just doesn't drink and goes to meetings. And he becomes popular because he's doing good. Because he is. He's not a real alcoholic. And he starts doing service commitments. He starts sponsoring guys. And he tells them, "Well, you just do this." And he's got this attitude, and he's happy, and he's like, "You just do it this way. That's all you're going to do. You don't want to do it that way? Go on, that's okay. It worked for me." And that's all he has to do. There's this progression thing we read about. It gets worse. I know so many people like this. I mean, I really know personally people like this. Some amazing, wonderful people who are gone now. And years go by, 10 or 15 years go by, and it's got a guy like this, Richard. I mean, I know specific people, and I don't want to use their names up here. And the day comes and they drink again. The real alcoholic, they say things, "Well, remember how bad it was. Remember what it was like." Well, folks, I can't remember what it was like. I cannot remember what it was like. They tell us on 24. "The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times," this is an important part here, "certain times to bring into consciousness with sufficient force the memory of suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. We can't remember how bad it was at certain times." And this is where and why when people say, "What were you thinking?" We really don't know. We weren't thinking. There was no thinker. The brain was flying with nobody at the controls. It was just going. At certain times. A guy like this Richard, he sticks around for a while, 5, 10, 15, even 20 years. The disease progresses. That certain time comes along. And he drinks. And now his disease is much farther on and he can't stop. And he's in his 50s or 60s now. And he doesn't have the advantages he had before. And he can't stop. And people say, "Don't drink and go to meetings." He's like, I know what to do. And they always say that. They come back, I know what to do. 90 or something. But he can't do it. And he doesn't make it. And then we read about him. And two people go to his funeral. Because he doesn't have any friends anymore. And he doesn't make it. Those are the two halves. I mean, I'd like to be funnier. I'd like to have more levity. But this ain't the common cold, folks. I do what I can to help people. I go back to rehab every week. I'm flying back tomorrow with hard main sleep. I'll be there Monday at 6 o'clock like I always am. Not because I'm going to try to save anybody. But because people are going to die and I'm just going to try to keep one less from dying. Maybe. You know. 5 died this year from that little class. And more are going to die. I would be one of them if I weren't doing this thing. Page 89, practical experience, shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking. Nothing People say it's open to interpretation. Okay, fine. Tell me that word that is an addition to nothing. Nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. Not that message. Not that out there message. Not that I heard that guy say message. And again, I'm speaking for me, folks. Y'all can carry whatever message you want. I read it. I'm still alive. I'm on borrowed time. Lots of it. And I am so grateful to still be alive. And that's the message I have to keep carrying. And that's the one I was hoping to bring to you guys. I get to have another day. I get to have another week. And I wouldn't have it if y'all didn't let me come here and do this thing that I learned in this book. And I am so grateful you let me come. Thanks so much.